Nobody knows. Well, hardly anyone. Enjoy that pie, boy. Dean Highbottom walked away without bothering to take a piece himself. Coriolanus wanted nothing so much as to drop his pie and run for the exit, but instead he carefully set the oversized slice back on the cart. The nickname. It could only be that the nickname had found its way back to Dean Highbottom, with Coriolanus given the credit. It had been stupid on his part. The dean was too powerful a person, even now, to be ridiculing in public. But was it really such a horrible thing? Every teacher had at least one nickname, many far less flattering, and it wasn't as if High as a Kite Bottom had made much effort to hide his habit. He seemed to invite derision. Could there be some other reason he hated Coriolanus so much? Whatever it was, Coriolanus needed to set it right. He could not risk losing his prize over such a thing. After university, he planned to embark on some lucrative profession. Without an education, what doors would be open to him? He tried to imagine his future in some low-level city position. Doing what? Managing the coal distribution to the districts? Cleaning cages of genetic freaks in the mutations lab? Collecting taxes from Sejanus Plinth in his palatial apartment on the Corso while he lived in some rat hole 50 blocks out? That's if he were lucky. Capital jobs were hard to come by, and he would become a penniless academy graduate, no more. How was he to live? Borrow? Being in debt in the capital was historically a ticket to being a peacekeeper, and that came with a 20-year commitment to who knew where. They'd ship him off to some horrid backwater district where the people were hardly better than animals. The day, which had held such promise, came crashing down around him. First the threat of losing his apartment, then the lowliest tribute assignment, who on further reflection was definitely crazy, and now the revelation that Dean Highbottom detested him enough to kill his prize chances and condemn him to a life in the districts. Everyone knew what happened if you went to the districts. You were written off, forgotten. In the eyes of the capital, you were basically dead. Chapter 3. Coriolanus stood on the empty train platform, awaiting his tribute's arrival. A long-stemmed white rose balanced carefully between his thumb and index finger. It had been Tigress's idea to bring her a gift. She had arrived home very late on the night of the reaping, but he had waited up to consult with her, to tell her of his humiliations and fears. She refused to let the conversation spin into despair. He would get a prize. He would have to. And have a brilliant university career. As to the apartment, they must find out the specifics first. Perhaps the tax would not affect them, or even if it did, maybe not soon. Maybe they could scrape up enough for the taxes somehow, but he was to think of none of that. Only of the Hunger Games, and how he might make a success of it. At Fabricia's reaping party, Tigress said everyone was nuts about Lucy Gray Baird. His tribute had star quality, her friends had declared as they drunkenly slurped their Posca. The cousins agreed that he needed to make a good first impression on the girl so that she would be willing to work with him. He should treat her not as a condemned prisoner, but as a guest. Coriolanus had decided to greet her early at the train station. It would give him a jump on the assignment, as well as an opportunity to win her trust. "Imagine how terrified she must be, Corio," Tigress had said. "How alone she must feel. If it was me, anything you could do to make me feel like you cared about me would go a long way. No, more than that, like I was of value. Take her something, even a token that lets her know you value her." Coriolanus thought about his grandmother's roses, which were still prized in the capital. The old woman nurtured them arduously in the roof garden that came with the penthouse, both out of doors and in a small solar greenhouse. She parceled out her flowers like diamonds, though, so it had taken a good bit of persuasion to get this beauty. I need to make a connection with her. As you always say, your roses open any doors. It was a testament to how worried his grandmother was about their situation that she had allowed it. 2 days had passed since the reaping. The city had held on to the oppressive heat, and even though it was just past dawn, the train station was beginning to bake. Coriolanus felt conspicuous on the wide, deserted platform, but he couldn't risk missing her train. The only information he could get out of his downstairs neighbor, game maker in training, Remus Doolittle, was that it was supposed to arrive Wednesday. Remus had recently graduated from the university, and his family had pulled in every favor they had to get him the position, which paid just enough and provided a stepping stone to the future. Coriolanus could have inquired through the academy, but he didn't know if greeting the train would be frowned upon. No rules had been laid out, per se, but he thought most of his classmates would wait to meet their tributes at a session overseen by the academy the following day. An hour passed, then two, and still no train of any kind appeared. The sun beat down through the glass panes of the station ceiling. Perspiration trickled down his back, and the rose, so majestic that morning, began to bend in resignation. He wondered if the whole idea was ill-conceived, and if he would get no thanks for greeting her in this way. Another girl, a typical girl, would be impressed, but there was nothing typical about Lucy Gray Baird. In fact, there was something intimidating about a girl who could pull off such a brazen performance on the heels of the mayor's assault. And that, just after she had dropped a venomous snake down another girl's dress. Of course, he didn't know that it was venomous, but that was where the mind went, wasn't it? She was terrifying, really. And here he was, in his uniform, clutching a rose like some love-struck schoolboy, hoping she would, what, like him? Trust him? Not kill him on sight? Her cooperation was imperative. Yesterday, Soteria had led a mentor meeting in which their first assignment had been detailed. In the past, the tributes had gone directly into the arena the morning after they'd all arrived in the capital, but the timeline had been extended now that the academy students were involved. It had been decided that each mentor was to interview their tribute and would be given 5 minutes to present them to Pan Am on a live television program. If people had someone to root for, they might actually have an interest in watching the Hunger Games. If all went well, it would be prime-time viewing. The mentors might even be invited to comment on their tributes during the games. Coriolanus promised himself that his 5 minutes would be the standout of the night. Another hour crawled by, and he was just about ready to give up, when a train whistle sounded deep in the tunnel. Those first few months of the war, the whistle had signaled his father's arrival from the battlefield. His father had felt that, as a munitions tycoon, military service enhanced his legitimacy in the family business. With an excellent head for strategy, nerves of steel, and a commanding presence, he'd quickly climbed the ranks. To publicly display their commitment to the capital cause, the Snow family would all travel to the station, Coriolanus in his velvet suit, to await the great man's return. Until the day the train brought only the news that a rebel bullet had found its mark. It was hard, in the capital, to find a spot that wasn't linked to a terrible memory, but this was particularly bad. He could not say he had felt great love for the remote, strict man, but he had certainly felt protected by him. His death was associated with a fear and a vulnerability that Coriolanus had never been able to shake off. The whistle blew as the train sped into the station and screeched to a halt. It was a short train, only an engine and two cars. Coriolanus looked for a glimpse of his tribute in the windows before he realized the cars had none. They were designed not for passengers, but for cargo. Heavy metal chains attached by old-fashioned padlocks secured the goods. The wrong train, he thought. Might as well go home. But then a distinctly human cry came from one of the cargo cars, and he remained in place. He expected a rush of peacekeepers, but the train sat ignored for 20 minutes before a few made their way to the rails. One of them exchanged words with an unseen engineer, and a set of keys was tossed out the window. The peacekeeper took his time meandering down to the first car, flipping through the keys before he selected one, stuck it in the padlock, and gave it a twist. The lock and chains fell away, and he rolled back the heavy door. The car appeared empty. The peacekeeper pulled out his baton and banged it against the door frame.
"All right, you lot, let's move!"
A tall boy with dark brown skin and patched burlap clothing appeared in the doorway. Coriolanus recognized him as Clemencia's tribute from District 11, rangy but muscular. A girl with similar coloring but a skeletal frame and a hacking cough joined him. Both of them were barefoot with their hands cuffed in front of their bodies. It was a 5-foot drop to the ground, so they sat on the edge of the car before launching themselves awkwardly onto the platform. A small, pasty-faced girl in a striped dress and red scarf crawled to the door, but seemed unable to figure out how to cover the distance to the ground. The peacekeeper yanked her down and she landed hard, barely catching herself with her bound hands. Then he reached into the car and dragged out a boy who looked about 10 years old, but had to be at least 12, and hauled him onto the platform as well. By now the smell of the car, musty and heavy with manure, had reached Coriolanus. They were transporting the tributes in livestock cars, and not very clean ones at that. He wondered if they had been fed and let out for fresh air or just locked in after their reapings. Accustomed as he was to viewing the tributes on screen, he had not prepared himself properly for this encounter in the flesh, and a wave of pity and revulsion swept through him. They really were creatures out of another world, a hopeless, brutish world. The peacekeeper moved on to the second car and released the chains. The door slid open, revealing Jessup, the male District 12 tribute, squinting into the brightly lit station. Coriolanus felt a jolt run through him, and his body straightened in anticipation. Surely she would be with him. Jessup hopped stiffly to the ground and turned back to the train. Lucy Gray Baird stepped into the light, her cuffed hands half covering her eyes as they adjusted. Jessup reached up his arms. His wrists spread as wide as the chain on his restraints would allow, and she fell forward, letting him catch her by the waist and swing her to the ground in a surprisingly graceful move. She patted the boy's sleeve in thanks and tilted her head back to drink in the sunlight streaming into the station. Her fingers began combing through her curls, untangling the knots and picking out bits of straw. Coriolanus's attention turned for a moment to the peacekeepers, who were hollering threats into the train car. When he gazed back, Lucy Gray was staring directly at him. He started a bit, but then remembered that he was the only one on the platform besides the peacekeepers. The soldiers were cursing now as they hoisted one of their number into the train car to retrieve the reluctant tributes. It was now or never. He crossed to Lucy Gray, extended the rose, and gave a small nod. "Welcome to the capital," he said. His voice was slightly gravelly, as he had not spoken for hours, but he thought it gave him a nice maturity. The girl sized him up, and for a minute he feared she was going to either walk away or, worse, laugh at him. Instead, she reached out and delicately plucked a petal from the flower in his hand.
"When I was little, they used to bathe me in buttermilk and rose petals," she said in a manner that, despite the unlikeliness of her claim, seemed totally believable.
She ran her thumb over the glossy white surface and slipped the petal into her mouth, closing her eyes to savor the flavor.
"Tastes like bedtime."
Coriolanus took the moment to examine her. She looked different than she had at the reaping. Except for flecks here and there, the makeup had been wiped away, and without it she appeared younger. Her lips were chapped, her hair loose, her rainbow dress dusty and rumpled. The mark from the mayor's blow had turned to a deep purple bruise. But there was something else, too. He again had the impression that he was witnessing a performance. but a private one this time. When she opened her eyes, she trained all her attention on him.
You don't look like you should be here.
I probably shouldn't be, he admitted. But I'm your mentor, and I wanted to meet you on my own terms, not the game makers.
Ah, a rebel, she said.
That word was poison in the mouths of capital citizens, but she had said it approvingly as a compliment. Or was she mocking him? He remembered she carried snakes in her pocket, and the usual rules didn't apply to her.
And what does my mentor do for me, besides bring me roses?
She asked. I do my best to take care of you, he said. She glanced over her shoulder where the peacekeepers were tossing two half-starved children onto the platform. The girl broke a front tooth on the platform, while the boy received several sharp kicks upon landing. Lucy Gray smiled up at Coriolanus. Well,
good luck, gorgeous, she said,
and walked back to Jessup, leaving him and his rose behind. As the peacekeepers herded the tributes across the station to the main entrance, Coriolanus felt his chance slipping away. He had not secured her trust. He had not done anything except perhaps amuse her for a moment. Clearly, she thought he was useless, and maybe she was right. But with all that was at stake, he had to try. He ran across the station, catching up to the pack of tributes as they reached the door. Excuse me, he said to the peacekeeper in charge. I'm Coriolanus Snow from the Academy. He inclined his head toward Lucy Gray. This tribute has been assigned to me for the Hunger Games. I wonder if I might accompany her to her quarters. That's why you've been hanging around here all morning? To catch a ride to the show? Asked the peacekeeper. He reeked of liquor and his eyes were rimmed with red. Well, by all means, Mr. Snow, join the party. It was then that Coriolanus saw the truck that awaited the tributes. Less a truck than a cage on wheels. The bed was enclosed by metal bars and topped with a steel roof. He again flashed back to the circus of his childhood, where he had seen wild animals, big cats and bears, confined to such transport. Following orders, the tributes presented their cuffs for removal and climbed into the cage. Coriolanus hung back, but then saw Lucy Gray watching him and knew this was the moment of judgment. If he backed down now, it would all be over. She would think he was a coward and dismiss him entirely. He took a deep breath and hoisted himself up into the cage. The door slammed shut behind him, and the truck lurched forward, knocking him off balance. He reflexively grabbed for the bars on his right and wound up with his forehead crammed between them as a couple of the tributes fell into him. He pushed back forcefully and twisted his body around to face his fellow passengers. Everyone had hold of at least one bar now, except the girl with the broken tooth who was clinging to the leg of the boy from her district. As the truck rumbled down a wide avenue, they began to settle in. Coriolanus knew he had made a mistake. Even in the open air, the stench was overwhelming. The tributes had absorbed the odor of the cattle car, and it mixed with an unwashed human smell that made him feel slightly nauseous. Up close, he could see how grubby they were, how bloodshot their eyes, how bruised their limbs. Lucy Gray was crammed into a corner at the front, dabbing a fresh scrape on her forehead with her ruffled hem. She seemed indifferent to his presence. But the rest of them stared at him like a pack of feral animals eyeing a pampered poodle. At least I'm in better condition than they are, he thought, and he made a fist around the stem of the rose. If they attack, I'll stand a chance. But would he? Against so many? The truck slowed to let one of the colorful street trolleys packed with people cross in front of it. Although he was in the back, Coriolanus hunched down to avoid being noticed. The trolley passed, the truck began to roll, and he dared to straighten up. They were laughing at him, the tributes, or at least some of them were grinning at his obvious discomfort. What's the matter, pretty boy?
You in the wrong cage? Said the boy from District 11, who was not laughing at all. The undisguised hatred rattled Coriolanus, but he tried to look unimpressed. No, this is exactly the cage I was waiting for. The boy's hands came up fast, encircling Coriolanus's throat with his long, scarred fingers and slamming him back. His forearms pinned Coriolanus's body against the bars. Overpowered, Coriolanus resorted to the one move that had yet to fail him in schoolyard scuffles, driving his knee up hard into the opponent's crotch. The district boy gasped and doubled over, releasing him.
He might kill you now, the girl from District 11 coughed in Coriolanus's face. He killed a peacekeeper back in 11. They never found out who did it.
Shut it, Dill, the boy growled.
Who cares now, said Dill.
Let's all kill him, the tiny boy said viciously. Can't do nothing worse to us. Several other tributes murmured in agreement and took a step in. Coriolanus went rigid with fear. Kill him? Did they really mean to beat him to death right here in broad daylight, in the middle of the capital? Suddenly he knew they did. What, after all, did they have to lose? His heart pounded in his chest, and he crouched slightly, fists extended, in anticipation of the imminent attack. From the corner, Lucy Gray's melodic voice broke the tension.
Not to us, maybe. You got family back home? Someone they could punish there?
This seemed to take the wind out of the other tribute's sails. She wriggled through and placed herself between them and Coriolanus.
Besides, she said, he's my mentor, supposed to help me. I might need him. How come you get a mender? Asked Dill.
Mentor, you each get one, explained Coriolanus, trying to sound on top of the situation.
Where are they then?
Dill challenged.
Why didn't they come?
Just not inspired, I guess, said Lucy Gray.
Turning from Dill, she gave Coriolanus a wink. The truck veered onto a narrow side street and bumped down to what appeared to be a dead end. Coriolanus could not quite get his bearings. He tried to remember where the tributes had been held in previous years. Hadn't it been in the stables that housed the peacekeeper's horses? Yes, he thought he had heard some mention of that. As soon as they arrived, he would find a peacekeeper and explain things. Perhaps ask for a bit of protection, given the hostility. After Lucy Gray's wink, it might be worthwhile to stay. They were backing in now to a dimly lit building, maybe a warehouse. Coriolanus inhaled a musky mix of rotten fish and old hay. Confused, he tried to get a better fix on his surroundings, and his eyes strained to make out two metal doors swinging open. A peacekeeper opened the back door to the truck, and before anyone could climb out, the cage tipped and dumped them onto a slab of cold, damp cement. Not a slab, actually more like a chute, for it was tilted at such an extreme angle that Coriolanus began to slide immediately, along with the rest. He dropped the rose as his hands and feet scrabbled for purchase but found none. They all traveled a good 20 feet before they landed in a jumbled heap on a gritty floor. Sunlight glared down on Coriolanus as he scrambled to untangle his body from the pack. He staggered out a few yards, righted himself, and froze in horror. This was not the stables. While he had not visited in many years, he remembered it clearly now. The stretch of sand, the artificial rock formations twisting high in the air, the row of metal bars engraved to look like vines curved in a wide arc to protect the audience. Between the sets of bars, the faces of capital children gawked at him. He was in the monkey house at the zoo. Chapter 4. He could not have felt more exposed had he been standing naked in the middle of the Corso. At least then he would have had the option to escape. Now he was trapped and on display, for the first time appreciating the animal's inability to hide. Children had begun to chatter excitedly and point at his school uniform, drawing the attention of the adults. Faces were filling all the available space between the bars.
But the real horror was a pair of cameras positioned at either end of the visitors. Capital News. With their omnipresent coverage and their saucy slogan, "If you didn't see it here, it didn't happen." Oh, it was happening. To him. Now. He could feel his image going live all over the Capitol. Fortunately, shock rooted him to the spot. Because the only thing worse than him standing among the district riffraff in the zoo would be him running around like a fool trying to escape. There was no easy way out. It was built for wild animals. Attempting to hide would be even more pathetic. Imagine how delicious that footage would be for Capitol News. They would play it ad nauseum. Add silly music and captions. Snow's meltdown. Make it part of the weather report. Too hot for snow. They would rerun it as long as he lived. His disgrace would be complete. What option did that leave him? Only to stand his ground, looking the cameras dead in the eye until he was rescued. He straightened up to his full height, subtly shifted back his shoulders, and attempted to look bored. The audience began to call out to him. First the high-pitched children's voices, then the adults joining in, asking what he was doing. Why was he in the cage? Did he need help? Someone recognized him, and his name spread like wildfire through the crowd, which was becoming deeper by the minute. "It's the Snow Boy. Who's that again? You know, the ones with the roses on their roof." Who were all these people hanging around on a weekday at the zoo? Didn't they have jobs? Shouldn't the children be in school? No wonder the country was such a mess. The district tributes began to circle, taunting him. There was the pair from District 11 and the vicious little boy who had called for his death, and several new ones, too. He remembered the hatred in the truck and wondered what would happen if they attacked him as a pack. Perhaps the audience would only cheer them on. Coriolanus tried not to panic, but he could feel sweat running down his sides. All the faces of the nearby tributes, of the crowd at the bars, began to blur. Their features became indistinct, leaving only dark and light patches of skin, broken by the pinkish red of their open mouths. His limbs felt numb. His lungs starved for air. He was beginning to consider making a break for the chute and attempting to climb it when a voice behind him softly said, "Own it." Without turning, he knew it was the girl. His girl. And he felt immense relief that he was not entirely alone. He thought of how cleverly she had played the audience after the mayor's assault, how she had won them all with her song. She was right, of course. He had to make this moment look intentional, or it was all over. He took a deep breath and turned to where she sat, casually fixing the white rose behind her ear. She always seemed to be improving her appearance, arranging her ruffles in District 12, grooming her hair at the train station, and now adorning herself with the rose. He extended his hand to her as if she was the grandest lady in the Capitol. The edges of Lucy Gray's mouth curled up. As she took his hand, her touch sent a tiny electrical spark up his arm, and he felt as if a bit of her onstage charisma had been transferred to him. He made a small bow as she stood with exaggerated elegance. "She's on stage, you're on stage. This is the show," he thought. He lifted his head and asked, "Would you care to meet a few of my neighbors?" "I would be delighted," she said, as if they were at an afternoon tea. "My left side is better," she murmured, lightly brushing her cheek. He wasn't sure what to do with the information, so he started to guide her to the left. Lucy Gray gave the spectators a big smile, seemingly pleased to be there. But as he led her to the bars, he could feel her fingers clenching his like a vice. A shallow moat that ran between the rocky structures and the bars of the monkey house had once formed a watery barrier between the animals and the visitors, but it was bone dry now. They descended three steps, crossed the moat, and climbed back up to a shelf that ran around the enclosure, putting them eye to eye with the patrons. Coriolanus chose a spot several yards from one of the cameras. Let it come to him, where a gaggle of small children stood in a cluster. The bars were spaced about 4 inches apart. Not enough room to slide a whole body between, but ample if you wanted to reach your hand through. The children fell silent as they approached, pressing back into their parents' legs. Coriolanus thought the afternoon tea image was as good as any, so he continued to treat the situation with the same lightness. "How do you do?" he said, leaning over to the children. "I brought along a friend of mine today. Would you like to meet her?" The children shifted around, and there were a few giggles.
Then one little boy shouted, "Yes!"
He slapped the bars with his hands a few times, then shoved them in his pockets uncertainly.
"We saw her on the television."
Coriolanus led Lucy Gray right up to the bars. "May I present Miss Lucy Gray Baird?" The audience had fallen silent now, nervous at her proximity to the children, but eager to hear what the strange tribute was going to say. Lucy Gray went down on one knee about a foot from the bars.
"Hi there. I'm Lucy Gray. What's your name?"
"Pontius,"
the boy said, glancing up to his mother for reassurance. She looked warily at Lucy Gray, but the girl ignored her.
"How do you do, Pontius?" she said.
Like any well-bred capital lad, the boy thrust his hand out to shake. Lucy Gray raised her hand to meet his, but refrained from sticking it through the bars, which might have appeared threatening. As a result, it was the boy who reached into the cage to make contact. She squeezed his little hand warmly.
"So nice to meet you. Is this your sister?"
Lucy Gray nodded to the little girl next to him. She stood saucer-eyed as she sucked on a finger.
"That's Venus," he said. "She's only 4.
"Well, I think 4 is a very smart age to be," said Lucy Gray. "Nice to meet you, Venus."
"I liked your song,"
whispered Venus.
"You did?" said Lucy Gray. "That's so sweet. Well, you keep watching, precious, and I'll try to sing you another, okay?"
Venus nodded and then buried her face in her mother's skirt, bringing laughter and a few awes from the crowd. Lucy Gray began to sidestep her way along the fence, engaging the children as she went. Coriolanus hung back a bit to give her space.
"Did you bring your snake?"
a girl clutching a dripping strawberry ice pop asked hopefully.
"I sure wish I could have. That snake was a particular friend of mine," Lucy Gray told her. "Do you have a pet?"
"I have a fish,"
said the girl. She leaned into the bars.
"His name is Bub."
She transferred her treat to her other hand and reached through the bars for Lucy Gray.
"Can I touch your dress?"
Streaks of ruby syrup ran from her fist to her elbow, but Lucy Gray just laughed and offered up a bit of her skirt. The girl ran a tentative finger over the ruffles.
"It's pretty."
"I like yours, too."
The girl's dress was a faded, printed thing, nothing to remark on. But Lucy Gray said,
"Polka dots always make me feel happy."
And the girl beamed. Coriolanus could sense the audience beginning to warm up to his tribute, no longer bothering to keep their distance. People were easy to manipulate when it came to their children, so pleased to see them pleased. Instinctively, Lucy Gray seemed to know this, ignoring the adults as she moved along. She had almost reached one of the cameras and its accompanying reporter. She must have sensed it, but when she rose and found it directly in her face, she gave a slight start, then laughed.
"Oh, hi there. Are we on television?"
The Capitol reporter, a young man eager for a story, leaned in hungrily. "We certainly are."
"And who might you be?"
she asked. "I'm Lepidus Malmsey with Capitol News," he said, flashing a grin. "So, Lucy, you're the tribute from District 12?
"It's Lucy Gray, and I'm not really from 12, she said. "My people are Covey, musicians by trade. We just took a wrong turn one day and were obliged to stay."
"Oh, so what district are you from then?" asked Lepidus.
"No district in particular. We move from place to place as the fancy takes us."
Lucy Gray caught herself.
Well, we used to, anyway, before the peacekeepers rounded us up a few years back.
But now you're District 12 citizens, he insisted.
If you say so.
Lucy Gray's eyes drifted back to the crowd as if she was in danger of being bored. The reporter could feel her slipping away. Your dress has been a big hit in the capital.
Has it? Well, the Covey love color, and me more than most. But this was my mama's, so it's extra special to me, she said.
She's in District 12? Lepidus asked.
Just her bones, darling. Just her pearly white bones.
Lucy Gray stared directly at the reporter, who seemed to have trouble forming his next question. She watched him struggle for a moment, then gestured to Coriolanus.
So, do you know my mentor? Says his name is Coriolanus Snow. He's a capital boy, and clearly I got the cake with the cream because nobody else's mentor even bothered to show up to welcome them.
Well, he gave us all a surprise. Did your teachers tell you to be here, Coriolanus? Asked Lepidus. Coriolanus stepped toward the camera and tried for likable with a hint of roguishness. They didn't tell me not to. Laughter rippled through the crowd. But I do remember them saying that I was to introduce Lucy Gray to the Capitol, and I take that job seriously. So you didn't have a second thought about diving into a cage of tributes? Prompted the reporter. A second, a third, and I imagine the fourth and fifth will be hitting me sometime soon, admitted Coriolanus. But if she's brave enough to be here, shouldn't I be?
Oh, for the record, I didn't have a choice, said Lucy Gray.
For the record, neither did I, said Coriolanus. After I heard you sing, I couldn't keep away. I confess, I'm a fan. Lucy Gray gave her skirt a swish as a smattering of applause came from the crowd. Well, I hope for your sake the Academy agrees with you, Coriolanus, said Lepidus. I think you're about to find out. Coriolanus turned to see metal doors, their windows reinforced with gates, swinging open in the back of the monkey house. A quartet of peacekeepers marched in and headed straight for him. He turned to the camera, intent on making a good exit. Thank you for joining us, he said. Remember, it's Lucy Gray Baird, representing District 12. Drop by the zoo if you have a minute and say hello. I promise she's well worth the effort. Lucy Gray extended her hand to him with the delicate droop of the wrist that invited a kiss. He obliged, and when his lips brushed her skin, he felt a pleasant tingle. After giving the audience one last wave, he stepped up calmly to meet the peacekeepers. One nodded tersely, and without a word he followed them from the enclosure to a respectable applause. When the doors closed behind him, his breath came out in a huff, and he realized how afraid he'd been. He silently congratulated himself for maintaining grace under pressure, but the scowls of the peacekeepers suggested they did not share his opinion. What are you playing at? A peacekeeper demanded. You're not allowed in there. So I thought, until your cohorts unceremoniously dumped me down a chute, Coriolanus replied. He thought the combination of cohorts and unceremoniously had just the right note of superiority. I only signed up for the ride to the zoo. I'd be happy to explain the whole thing to your presiding officer and identify the peacekeepers who did this, but to you I offer my thanks. Uh-huh, she said flatly. We have orders to escort you to the Academy. Even better, said Coriolanus, sounding more confident than he felt. The quick reaction from the school unsettled him. Although the television in the back seat of the peacekeeper van was broken, he was able to catch glimpses of the story along the way on the huge public screens that dotted the Capitol. Nervous energy began to bubble up as he saw images of first Lucy Gray, then himself beaming out over the city. He could never have planned anything this audacious, but since it had happened, he might as well enjoy it. And really, he thought, he had given a fine performance. Kept his head, stood his ground, featured the girl, and she was a natural. Handled it all with dignity and a little ironic humor. By the time he reached the Academy, he had recovered his composure and ascended the steps with assurance. It helped that every head was turning his way, And had there been no peacekeepers to hold them at bay, he felt sure his schoolmates would have swarmed him. He thought he'd be taken to the office, but the guard deposited him on the bench outside the door to, of all places, the high biology lab, which was restricted to the senior students most gifted in the science. Although it was not his favorite subject, the smell of formaldehyde triggered his gag reflex and he loathed working with a partner, he did sufficiently well in genetic manipulation to have landed a spot in the class. Nothing like that whiz Io Jasper, who seemed to have been born with a microscope attached to her eye. He was always gracious to Io, though, and as a result, she adored him. With unpopular people, such a minor effort went such a long way. But who was he to feel superior? Across from the bench, on the bulletin board for student notices, a memo had been posted. It read, 10th Hunger Games Mentor Assignments. District 1. Boy, Livia Cardew. Girl, Palmyra Monti. District 2. Boy, Sejanus Plinth. Girl, Floris Friend. District 3. Boy, Io Jasper. Girl, Urban Canville. District 4. Boy, Persephone Price. Girl, Festus Creed. District 5. Boy, Dennis Fling. Girl, Iphigenia Moss. District 6. Boy, Apollo Ring. Girl, Diana Ring. District 7. Boy, Vipsania Sickle. Girl, Pliny Harrington. District 8. Boy, Juno Phipps. Girl, Hilarius Heavensby. District 9. Boy, Gaius Breen. Girl, Androcles Anderson. District 10. Boy, Domitia Whimsywick. Girl, Arachne Crane. District 11. Boy, Clemencia Dovecote. Girl, Felix Ravenstill. District 12. Boy, Lysistrata Vickers. Girl, Coriolanus Snow. Could there be a more stinging public reminder of his precarious position than to be dangling there at the end like an afterthought? After Coriolanus spent a few minutes puzzling over why he'd been brought to the lab, the guard told him he could go in. At his tentative knock, a voice he recognized as Dean Highbottom's bid him enter. He had expected Soteria to be present, but found only one other person in the lab, a small, stooped old woman with frizzy gray hair who was teasing a caged rabbit with a metal rod. She poked at it through the mesh until the creature, which had been modified to have the jaw strength of a pit bull, yanked the thing from her hand and snapped it in two. Then she straightened as well as she could, turned her attention to Coriolanus, and exclaimed, "Hippity-hoppity!" Dr. Volumnia Gall, the head game maker and mastermind behind the Capitol's Experimental Weapons Division, had unnerved Coriolanus since childhood. On a school field trip, his class of 9-year-olds had watched as she'd melted the flesh off a lab rat with some sort of laser, and then asked if anyone had any pets they were tired of. Coriolanus had no pets. How could they afford to feed one? But Pluribus Bell had a fluffy white cat named Boa Bell that would lie in her owner's lap and bat around the ends of his powdered wig. She had taken a fancy to Coriolanus and would start up a raspy, mechanical purr the moment he petted her head. On those dreary days when he'd slogged through the wintry slush to trade back a bag of lima beans for more cabbage, it was her silly, silky warmth that had consoled him. It upset him to think of Boa Bell ending up in the lab. Coriolanus knew Dr. Gall taught a class at the university, but he'd seldom seen her at the academy. As head game maker, though, anything related to the Hunger Games fell under her purview. Could his trip to the zoo have brought her here? Was he about to lose his mentorship?
"Hippity-hoppity," Dr. Gall grinned. "How's the zoo?"
Then she was laughing.
"It's like a children's rhyme. Hippity-hoppity, how's the zoo? You fell in a cage and your tribute did too."
Coriolanus's lips stretched into a weak smile as his eyes darted over to Dean Highbottom for some clue as to how to react. The man sat slumped at a lab table, rubbing his temple in a way that suggested he had a pounding headache. No help there. I did, Coriolanus said. We did. We fell in a cage. Dr. Gall raised her eyebrows at him, as if expecting more.
And?
And we landed on stage? He added.
Ha! Exactly! That's exactly what you did.
Dr. Gall gave him an approving look.
You're good at games. Maybe one day you'll be a game maker.
The thought had never crossed his mind. No disrespect to Remus, but it didn't seem like much of a job. Or like it required any particular skill, tossing kids and weapons in an arena and letting them fight it out. He supposed they had to organize the reapings and film the games, but he hoped for a more challenging career. I've got a great deal to learn before I can even think of that, he said modestly.
The instinct is there. That's what matters, said Dr. Gall. So tell me, what made you go into the cage?
It had been an accident. He was about to say so when he thought of Lucy Gray whispering the words,
Own it.
Well, my tribute, she's on the small side, the kind who's gone in the first 5 minutes of the Hunger Games. But she's appealing, in a scruffy sort of way, with the singing and all. Coriolanus paused for a moment, as if reviewing his plan. I don't think she stands a chance of winning, but that isn't the point, is it? I was told we were trying to engage the audience. That's my assignment, to get people to watch. So I asked myself, how do I even reach the audience? I go where the cameras are. Dr. Gall nodded.
Yes. Yes, there's no Hunger Games without the audience.
She turned to the dean.
You see, Casca, this one took the initiative. He understands the importance of keeping the games alive.
Dean Highbottom squinted at him skeptically. Does he? Or is he just showboating for a better grade? What do you think the purpose of the Hunger Games is, Coriolanus? To punish the districts for the rebellion, Coriolanus said without hesitation. Yes, but punishment could take a myriad of forms, said the dean. Why the Hunger Games? Coriolanus opened his mouth and then hesitated. Why the Hunger Games? Why not just drop bombs or cancel food shipments or stage executions on the steps of the district justice buildings? His mind jumped to Lucy Gray kneeling at the bars of the cage, engaging the children, the thawing of the crowd. They were connected in some way that he couldn't quite articulate. Because, it's because of the children. How they matter to people. How do they matter? Dean Highbottom pressed. People love children, said Coriolanus. But even as the words came out of his mouth, he questioned them. During the war, he had been bombed and starved and abused in multiple ways, and not just by the rebels. A cabbage ripped from his hands, a peacekeeper bruising his jaw when he mistakenly wandered too close to the president's mansion. He thought of the time he had collapsed and lain in the street with the swan flu and no one would stop to help. Racked with chills, burning with fever, limbs spiked with pain. Even though she was sick herself, Tigress had found him that night and somehow gotten him home. He faltered. Sometimes they do, he added, but it lacked conviction. When he thought about it, people's love of children seemed a very fickle thing. I don't know why, he admitted. Dean Highbottom shot Dr. Gall a look. You see, it's a failed experiment.
It is, if no one watches, she snapped back.
She gave Coriolanus an indulgent smile.
He's a child himself. Give him time. I've got a good feeling about this one. Well, I'm off to visit my mutts.
She patted Coriolanus on the arm as she shuffled toward the door.
Very hush-hush, but there's something wonderful going on with the reptiles.
Coriolanus made as if to follow, but Dean Highbottom's voice stopped him. So your whole performance was planned. That's odd, because when you stood up in the cage, I thought you were thinking about running. It was rather a more physical entrance than I had envisioned. It took some time to get my bearings. Again, I have a great many things to learn, said Coriolanus, boundaries being among them.
You'll be receiving a demerit for engaging in reckless behavior that could have injured a student. You, namely. It will go on your permanent record, said the dean.
A demerit? What did that even mean? Coriolanus would have to review the Academy student guide so he could object to the punishment. He was distracted by the dean, who pulled a small bottle from his pocket, twisted it open, and applied 3 drops of clear liquid to his tongue. Whatever was in the bottle, most likely morphling, worked quickly, because Dean Highbottom's whole body relaxed and a dreaminess settled in his eyes. He smiled unpleasantly.
3 such demerits, and you'll be expelled.
Chapter 5. Coriolanus had never received an official reprimand of any kind, nothing that would stain his spotless record. But, he started to protest,
go, before you receive a 2nd for insubordination, said Dean Highbottom.
There was no give in the statement, no invitation to negotiate. Coriolanus did as he'd been directed. Had Dean Highbottom actually used the word expelled? Coriolanus left the academy in a state of agitation, but once again the rush of attention quieted his distress. From his fellow students in the hallway, from Tigris and the Grand Mam as they ate a quick supper of fried eggs and cabbage soup, from complete strangers as he made his way back to the zoo that evening, eager to keep his hand in the games. The soft orange glow of the sunset suffused the city, and a cool breeze swept away the suffocating heat of the day. Officials had extended the zoo's hours until 9 o'clock, allowing the citizens to see the tributes. But there had been no more live coverage since his earlier visit. Coriolanus had decided to make another appearance to check on Lucy Gray and suggest she sing another song. The audience would love that, and perhaps it would draw the cameras back again. As he wound through the paths to the zoo, he was filled with nostalgia for the pleasant days he'd spent there as a child, but he felt saddened by the emptiness of the cages. They had once been full of fascinating creatures from the capital's genetic ark. Now, in one, a lone tortoise lay in the mud, wheezing. A bedraggled toucan squawked high in the branches, fluttering freely from one enclosure to the next. They were rare survivors of the war, as most animals had starved or been eaten. A pair of scrawny raccoons that had likely wandered in from the adjacent city park dug in an overturned trash can. The only beasts thriving were the rats that chased one another around the edges of fountains and scurried across the path mere feet away. As Coriolanus neared the monkey house, the paths became more populated, and a crowd of about 100 people curved from one side of the bars to the other. Someone jostled his arm as they sped by, and he recognized Lepidus Malmsey pushing ahead through the visitors with the cameraman. A sort of commotion was occurring down front, and he climbed up on a boulder to get a better view. To his chagrin, he saw Sejanus standing at the edge of the cage with a large backpack beside him. He held what appeared to be a sandwich through the bars, offering it to the tributes within. For the moment, they were all hanging back. Coriolanus could not hear his words, but he seemed to be trying to coax Dill, the girl from District 11, to take it. What was Sejanus up to? Was he trying to outdo him and steal the day's thunder? To take his idea of coming to the zoo and then dress it up in a way Coriolanus could never compete with, because he could never afford to? Was that whole pack filled with sandwiches? That girl wasn't even his tribute. When Sejanus caught sight of Coriolanus, his face brightened and he waved him over. Casually, Coriolanus made his way through the crowd, soaking up their attention. Trouble? He said as he surveyed the backpack. It was overflowing with not only sandwiches, but fresh plums as well.
None of them trust me. And why should they? Asked Sejanus.
A self-important little girl marched up beside them and pointed to a sign on the pillar at the edge of the enclosure.
It says, please don't feed the animals. They're not animals, though, said Sejanus. They're kids, like you and me.
They're not like me, the little girl protested. They're district. That's why they belong in a cage.
once again, like me, said Sejanus dryly. Coriolanus, do you think you could get your tribute to come over? If she does, the others might. They have to be starving. Coriolanus's mind worked quickly. He had already received one demerit today and did not wish to push his luck with Dean Highbottom. On the other hand, the demerit had been for endangerment of a student, and he was perfectly safe on this side of the bars. Dr. Gall, who was arguably more influential than Dean Highbottom, had complimented his initiative. And in truth, he had no interest in ceding the stage to Sejanus. The zoo was his show, and he and Lucy Gray were the stars. Even now he could hear Lepidus whispering his name to the cameraman, feel the viewers in the capital watching him. He spotted Lucy Gray at the back of the enclosure, washing her hands and face at a faucet that jutted from the wall at knee height. She dried herself on the ruffled skirt, arranged her curls, and adjusted the rose behind her ear. "I can't treat her like it's feeding time at the zoo," Coriolanus told Sejanus. It was not consistent with his treatment of her as a lady to be shoving food to her through the bars. "Not mine, but I could offer her dinner." Sejanus nodded immediately. "Take whatever. Ma made extra, please." Coriolanus chose 2 sandwiches and 2 plums from the pack and crossed to the edge of the monkey house, where a flat rock provided a likely seat. Never in his life, not even in the worst years, had he left home without a clean handkerchief in his pocket. The grandmam insisted on certain civilities that held chaos at bay. There were great drawers of them going back generations, plain to lacy to embroidered with flowers. He spread out the worn, slightly rumpled square of white linen and laid out the food. As he seated himself, Lucy Gray drifted up to the bars unbidden.
"Are those sandwiches for anybody?" she asked.
"Just for you," he answered. She tucked her feet under her and accepted a sandwich. After examining its contents, she took a nibble from the corner.
"Aren't you eating?"
He wasn't sure. The optics so far were good, singling her out again, presenting her as someone of value. But to eat with her? That might cross a line. "I'd rather you have it," he said. "Keep up your strength."
"Why? So I can break Jessup's neck in the arena? We both know that's not my forte," she said.
His stomach growled at the smell of the sandwich. A thick slice of meatloaf on white bread. He'd missed his lunch at the academy today, and breakfast and supper had been meager at home. A dollop of ketchup oozing out of Lucy Gray's sandwich tipped the scale. He lifted the second sandwich and sank his teeth in. A little shock of delight ran through his body, and he resisted the impulse to devour the sandwich in a couple of bites.
"Now it's like a picnic."
Lucy Gray looked back at the other tributes, who had moved in closer but still seemed uncertain.
"You all should get one. They're real good," she called. "Go on, Jessup."
Emboldened, her hulking district partner slowly approached Sejanus and took the sandwich from his hand. He waited until a plum followed and then walked off without a word. Suddenly the other tributes rushed the fence, hands thrusting through the bars. Sejanus filled them as fast as he could, and within a minute the backpack was almost depleted. The tributes spread out around the cage, crouched protectively over their food, wolfing it down. The only tribute who had not approached Sejanus was his own, the boy from District 2. He stood at the back of the cage, arms folded across his colossal frame, staring down his mentor. Sejanus pulled 1 final sandwich from the backpack and held it out to him.
"Marcus, this is for you. Take it, please."
But Marcus remained stone-faced and immobile.
"Please, Marcus," Sejanus pleaded. "You must be starving."
Marcus looked Sejanus up and down, then pointedly turned his back on him. Lucy Gray watched the standoff with interest.
"What's going on there?"
"What do you mean?" Coriolanus asked.
"I don't know exactly," she said, "but it feels personal."
The tiny boy who'd wanted to murder Coriolanus in the truck sprinted up and snatched the unclaimed sandwich. Sejanus made no move to stop him. The news team tried to engage Sejanus, but he brushed them off and disappeared into the crowd, the limp pack over his shoulder. They shot a bit more of the tributes, then headed toward Lucy Gray and Coriolanus, who sat up straighter and ran his tongue over his teeth to clean off the meatloaf. "We're here at the zoo with Coriolanus Snow and his tribute, Lucy Gray Baird. Another student just passed out sandwiches. Is he a mentor?" Lepidus thrust the mic at them for an answer. Coriolanus didn't like sharing the spotlight, but Sejanus's presence could protect him. Would Dean Highbottom give a demerit to the son of the man who had rebuilt the academy? A few days ago, he would have thought the name Snow carried more weight than Plinth, but the reaping assignments had proven him wrong. If Dean Highbottom wanted to call him on the carpet, he'd prefer to have Sejanus by his side. "He's my classmate, Sejanus Plinth," he informed Lepidus. "What's he up to? Bringing fancy sandwiches to the tributes? Surely the capital feeds them," said the reporter.
"Oh, for the record, I last ate the night before the reaping," Lucy Gray announced. "So I guess it's been 3 days.
"Oh. Okay, well, you enjoy that sandwich," said Lepidus. He signaled the camera to turn back to the other tributes. Lucy Gray was on her feet in a flash, leaning into the bars and pulling back the focus.
"You know, Mr. Reporter, what might be nice? If anybody has any food to spare, they might bring it on down to the zoo. No fun watching the games if we're all too weak to fight, don't you think?"
"There's some truth to that," said the reporter, unsure.
"Me? I like sweet things, but I'm not picky."
She smiled and bit into her plum.
"Okay.
Okay then," he said, easing away. Coriolanus could tell the reporter was on shaky ground. Should he really be helping her solicit the citizens for food? Did it seem a condemnation of the capital? As the news team moved to the other tributes, Lucy Gray settled back down across from him.
"Too much?"
"Not for me.
I'm sorry I didn't think to bring you food," he said. "Well, I've been working my way through these rose petals when nobody's looking," she shrugged. "You didn't know."
They finished their food in silence, watching the reporter's failed attempts at getting the other tributes to talk. The sun had set now, and a rising moon had taken over the lighting. The zoo would be closing soon.
"I was thinking that it might be a good idea for you to sing again," said Coriolanus.
Lucy Gray sucked the last bit of flesh off the plum pit.
"Mm-hmm. It might be, at that."
She dabbed the corners of her mouth with a ruffle and then straightened her skirt. Her usual playful tone shifted to a sober one.
"So, as my mentor, what do you get out of this? You're at school, right? So you get what? A better grade the more I shine?"
"Maybe." He felt embarrassed. Here in the relative privacy of the corner, he realized for the first time that she would be dead in a few days. Well, of course, he'd always known that. But he had thought about her more as his contender, his filly in a race, his dog in a fight. The more he had treated her as something special, the more she'd become human. As Sejanus had told the little girl, Lucy Gray was not really an animal, even if she was not capital. And he was here doing what? Showboating, like Dean Highbottom had said?
"I don't even know what I get, really," he told her.
They've never had mentors before. "You don't have to. Sing, I mean."
"I know," she said.
He still wanted her to, though. "But if people like you, they might bring you more food. We don't have much extra at home." His cheeks burned in the dark. Why on earth had he admitted that to her?
"No, I always thought you had plenty to spare in the capital," she said.
"Idiot," he said to himself. But then he met her gaze and realized that, for the first time, she looked genuinely interested in him. "Oh, no. Especially not during the war. One time I ate half a jar of paste just to stop the pains in my stomach."
"Yeah? How was it?" she asked.
That threw him, and he surprised himself by laughing. "Really sticky," Lucy Gray grinned.
I'll bet. Still, sounds better than some of the stuff I made do with. Not to make this a competition.
Of course not, he grinned back.
Look, I'm sorry. I'll find you some food. You shouldn't have to perform for it. Well, this wouldn't be the first time I sang for my supper. Not by a long shot, she said. And I do so love to sing.
A voice came over the speaker to announce the zoo was closing in 15 minutes. I ought to be going. But I'll see you tomorrow? He asked.
You know where to find me, she said.
Coriolanus rose and brushed off his pants. He shook out the handkerchief, folded it, and passed it through the bars to her.
It's clean, he assured her.
At least she'd have something to dry her face with.
Thanks. I left mine at home, she replied.
Lucy Gray's mention of home hung in the air between them. A reminder of a door she'd never reopen. Loved ones she'd never see again. He couldn't stand the thought of being torn from his own home. The apartment was the one place he unquestioningly belonged. His safe harbor. His family's stronghold. Since he didn't know how else to respond, he simply nodded goodnight. Coriolanus had not gone 20 paces when he was stopped by the sound of his tribute's voice, singing sweet and clear through the night air.
Down in the valley, valley so low, late in the evening, hear the train blow. The train, love, hear the train blow. Late in the evening, hear the train blow.
The audience, which had been trailing out, turned to listen to her.
Go build me a mansion. Build it so high, so I can see my true love go by. See him go by, love. See him go by. So I can see my true love go by.
Everyone had hushed now. The audience, the tributes. There was just Lucy Gray and the whir of the camera closing in on her. She still sat in their corner, her head leaning against the bars.
Go write me a letter. Send it by mail. Bake it and stamp it to the Capitol Jail. Capitol Jail, love. To the Capitol Jail. Bake it and stamp it to the Capitol Jail.
She sounded so sad. So lost.
Roses are red, love. Violets are blue. Birds in the heavens know I love you. Know I love you. Oh, know I love you. Birds in the heavens know I love you.
Coriolanus stood transfixed by the music and the rush of memories that accompanied it. His mother used to sing him a song at bedtime. Not this one, exactly, but it had used those same words. Roses are red, and violets are blue. It had mentioned loving him. He thought of the photo in the silver frame he kept on the nightstand by his bed. His beautiful mother holding him when he was about 2. They were looking at each other, laughing. Try as he might, he could never remember the moment the picture was taken. But this song caressed his brain, calling her from the depths. He could sense her presence, almost smell the delicate scent of the rose powder she wore, and feel the warm blanket of security that had enveloped him each night, before she died. Before that awful stretch of days a few months into the war, when the first major rebel air raid had immobilized the city, when she went into labor, and they were unable to get her to the hospital, and something had gone wrong. Hemorrhage, maybe? A great deal of blood soaking the sheets, and cook and the grandmam trying to stop it, and Tigress dragging him from the room. Then she was gone, and the baby, who would have been his sister, she was gone too. The death of his father came right on the heels of his